Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net.
Hannah, the Super Bowl is over. Not like the Super Bowl, but our Super Bowl.
It is.
I can't believe award season is finished.
Thank goodness. It was a long award season, but every year, it was a short season, but it still felt long.
It felt very long. Did you watch all of the Oscars?
I sure did. It was, 3.5 hours or so?
And I don't... To that point, and I saw some tweets for you. Oh, it's going to be so long. There's an opening musical montage. I don't care that the Oscars are long. I like the Oscars. I like watching people celebrate film. No one complains that the Super Bowl is too long.
No, but the Super Bowl, you have this sort of perpetual action and some real drama. I wasn't feeling any real drama in this particular telecast.
Hmm. You didn't, after one particular gentleman kept getting up on stage receiving all of those statues
that we did not see coming? But no, I did see it coming. And so the thing is that the drama, once Parasite racked up, once the best director was named, I knew it would win best picture.
I thought they'd split it. I thought they'd like, okay, Director Bong, here's your statue, but you're not going to get the picture.
I didn't think so. I felt that the momentum was with Parasite. The people were just sort of checking it off all the boxes to make sure it got something. And by doing so, it kind of got everything.
You don't think they thought it was the best film?
I think that there was a lot of Hollywood groupthink going on where Parasite was concerned. And yes, it's a very good film. Was it, to me, the best picture of the year? No, I reserve that for things that I really enjoy more. My favorite award of the night was that Jojo Rabbit won for Best Adapted Screenplay, because to me, that was such an incredible adaptation. Like, who could actually make this movie from this book? And so that, to me, was the kind of a vindication that I was looking for. I did very well with my picks. I only missed really just a few here and there. I got pretty much all these even smaller categories that I usually don't get. We did good. We picked everything on the shorts and the, we nailed most of them. It was just a couple of those, is it going to be Parasite or is it going to be 1917 conflicts? And in the end, it was Parasite.
The Oscars actually proved they saved us a little bit by not having a host. I really enjoyed Janelle Monáe's kickoff musical number. I thought it worked. I love everything about it. And then they brought on Steve Martin and Chris Rock, and both have hosted in the past, and here they are kind of co-doing an opening monologue, and it felt so stale, and the jokes weren't landing. I was like, man, this is what it could have been.
No, see, I felt the opposite. I felt the Janelle Monáe number just kind of, just sort of delayed the show from really taking off and getting to the awards, which is really what it's supposed to be about. And I enjoyed seeing Steve Martin and Chris Rock, and I feel like there is a middle ground. There's something that has to be done to make this telecast flow and to work better. And I think there's still room to bring back a host, but just to really keep it moving along. And so I think that one thing it did show is that some of those host bits, the writing was pretty sharp for a change. I actually thought when we did have some clever banter before a presentation, it was pretty good stuff. It seemed to be landing. And so I think there is room to bring back the right kind of host. I did not think the Eminem performance was necessary. I'm like, why now? Why are we doing this in the middle of this very long show? And when we already have 5 very good performances to be displayed with the musical numbers that are nominated, I just didn't see a reason for the Eminem other than just sort of trying to throw everything in the kitchen sink in there about trying to show how just how hip the Oscars can be. And I think it was trying to be too many things at once. And I just think they need to reformat the whole thing and just kind of keep it moving and get some of those bigger awards out and let us all see them before 11:30 when everybody is leaving their Oscar parties early because they have to get to work the next day.
And this is good. I'm glad we agree on nothing about the Oscars. It's been award season, which means most of the films have been good, which means we've been agreeing. And this is not a podcast between people who are supposed to be agreeable all the time. And man, we are on so different icebergs with the Academy Awards. I loved everything about the Eminem performance. I'm glad there wasn't a host. You know who was funny? Josh Gad. He comes out to introduce Idina Menzel, and he says, it's pronounced just like it's spelled. And she, even though it's not the best song, she gave the greatest performance of the evening with Into the Unknown, when all of these foreign singers come out and sing Into the Unknown in different languages.
We are completely on different pages with this.
I loved everything about that.
I thought, I knew Cynthia Erivo would nail her performance from Harriet because I've heard her sing live before, and I thought that was phenomenal. To me, Into the Unknown was one of the weakest, in there. I love Idina Menzel, don't get me wrong. She's a power singer, and I thought it was very cool that they brought out, you know, these women from other voiceover roles from other countries. But yeah, overall, I just think that Cynthia Erivo, if I had to pick my favorite.
Well, I'm not saying Idina should have won the statue. She should not have.
But that
Cynthia
wasn't my,
should have.
But that wasn't my favorite musical performance.
And they gave it to that hack, Elton John. Who is he?
Elton John, it's like you wanted to see Elton win that.
No,
and
I didn't.
You knew he was I'm speaking for the masses, not for you. But I think Hollywood wanted to see him win that. And my only disappointment there was I really thought, it's like, where's Taron Egerton? I really thought he would sort of show up and they'd reveal him in some sort of duet, which I think would have been killer.
I did half expect to see him as well. But Parasite, big winner, swept it. Most everyone seems pretty happy with it. Director Bong is now, he's a meme. He's beloved. Everybody loves him some Director
Bong.
I'm going
to go drink until morning. That's, I think, what his message was.
And his translator, his interpreter, is a superstar.
She is. And again, this was not a year where I had overwhelming favorites. And because I didn't, I'm okay with Parasite winning because I just didn't feel that there was anything that would have... that just would have been that perfect film for me that would have won. So I'm okay with Parasite winning.
All right. Back to the grind. We did not see this is a long weekend. Long 4-day President's Day weekend. Should help the box office. We did not see what it will win the box office.
And Valentine's Day weekend.
Sonic the Hedgehog, which went into a re-roll because no one liked the way Sonic looked, but it's got a fresh tomato. Jim Carrey apparently is doing very well, and I'm going to see it this weekend with my son. That's why I skipped the screening.
Yeah, and I just skipped it because I think it was just too far away for me to make it in time. And it also is a family film, and I just really was kind of worn out. But I've heard decent things about it, so I think if you're going to take the kids, it's probably going to be a very enjoyable film. Unlike the one that opens completely cold, Blumhouse's Fantasy Island.
We did not see that because it was not offered, but it will come in second place this weekend,
which will
counter-programming to Valentine's Day.
I don't know. I hope not because
there's always a horror movie on Valentine's Day.
But I've heard nothing about this film.
Well,
absolutely
no
nothing. But there's nobody has any right messing with Fantasy Island. I mean, you don't mess with my 1970s, early 80s Saturday night television by turning Mr. Rourke and Tattoo into like these horrifying figures. So that to me, right from the get-go, is just a bad move. And so I just hope that this film tanks, also because they didn't want to show it to us.
Well, we are going to start with a film that probably won't even crack the top 10. It's a remake, and it has two big, relatively big stars in it. It's a remake of 2014's Force Majeure from Sweden. It was nominated for the Foreign Film Golden Globe. Not the Oscar, but the Golden Globe. But it won, more importantly, it won WAFCA. It won the Washington, D.C. Film Critics Association Foreign Film Award. It's from Nat Faxon and Jim Rash. We know them from the way, way back.
Love that movie.
2013, that movie. If you remember Sam Rockwell, Toni Collette, and Steve Carell hanging out at the water park.
Awesome film.
I boycotted Downhill. I boycotted it. I'm tired of America stealing perfectly okay foreign films and remaking them into schlock.
It's not schlock. And people who, I wanted you to see this because I didn't see Force Majeure. And so I really wanted the comparison. I wanted to actually understand what was similar and what was not, because there have been two different camps on this film. I have seen some critics who are basically saying this is not your shot-by-shot remake in the way that, like, Liam Neeson's Cold Pursuit was recently, where that was identical to its, like, Norwegian counterpart. This, I'm told, takes a different approach in some of it, and while I didn't love downhill, you don't like it. You sort of come out of it and you think about it a little bit. It's a very different kind of performance for Julia Louis-Dreyfus and for Will Ferrell. It's not a comedy, so anybody who watches the trailer and thinks they're stepping into a comedy, this is not it. It is a dramedy, sort of a family dynamics drama, and I appreciated Julia Louis-Dreyfus does most of the heavy lifting emotionally in this film, and it's just about. The premise is generally similar to Force Majeure, I as far as I can tell, where this family is on a ski trip in the Alps, and there's a bit of a strain, an obvious strain going on in the relationship. The guy seems a little bit like midlife crisis mode, and the family, they're there with their two boys, and the family's sitting outside in this picturesque dining area, and a controlled avalanche starts coming their way, and they think that maybe they're going to be completely killed and buried alive by this avalanche. And whereas Billy, the Julia Louis-Dreyfus character, she immediately moves to protect her children instinctively. Her husband grabs his cell phone and basically runs away, and then comes back when the danger's over and is just sort of calmly sits back down and orders soup. And that sets up really the next several days at this mountain resort where the couple is forced to sort of re-examine their relationship as a family. And it's got some very poignant moments, some very funny moments. And it has definitely an indie vibe to it. So I liked it. I just didn't love it.
The setup sounds the same. I'm sure the execution is different enough where, okay, it feels different, but the setup's the same. It has a Rotten Tomato, but I did notice at least three of our local critics really liked it. Dustin Putman, Lauren Bradshaw, and I loved Roxana Hadidi's tweet about, I love watching rich people feel and look miserable.
And Chris Reed as well. He basically was just slamming anybody, any critic that was diminishing what this film was going for and what it was. And so he was lobbying for it intensively. And so it really just depends on what you're in the mood for. But if you think you're going to some Valentine's Day romantic comedy, that is not what Downhill is. And so if you didn't see Force Majeure and you're just sort of basing it off of the trailer and these two leads, it's just important to kind of understand what you're walking into.
But the talent behind the camera, Nat Faxon and Jim Rash, they are talented enough to go and create or adapt something from, I don't know, a book. Jim Rash actually has an Oscar for doing that. It's called The Descendants with George Clooney.
Mm-hmm.
Why remake a film that has already been done?
Well, and that's the age-old question that we ask every time one of these American remakes. We had one last year with The Upside that was the remake of
The Intouchables,
which was an amazing film that I always tell people they should see the original. But those who saw only the American remake still like that story. So I think that's why they do it, is because they're like, you know what? Not that many Americans really saw
it. Just
Force
leaves
Majeure.
A sour taste in my mouth. It's got this feeling of ripoff.
It's a ripoff, but they're trying to make a story that they felt was a really good story.
They're trying to
accessible.
Make a quick buck.
I'm not.
And
sure.
Downhill's gonna lose money.
We'll see. I mean, I hope it doesn't. I hope it doesn't completely tank, because I don't think it deserves to. I just think that. It's always a slippery slope when you're dealing with remakes.
Let's lighten the mood. Let's introduce a breath of fresh air called Portrait of a Lady on Fire. Perhaps you've heard the scuttlebutt about this film, nominated for a WAFTA, not nominated for an Oscar, because it's from France, and France gets to submit one film per year for the Best International Film category, and the French Academy chose to make it Les Misérables. Yes. We talked about that a couple weeks ago. And they did that because they catered to the Academy. They say Americans appear to like films about the underdog, films about minorities, a day in the life of, you know, maybe we'll rise up and try to change our situation. So they chose not to give it to the better film, which is Portrait of a Lady on Fire, which has this mood, this atmosphere, this gorgeous cinematography, and it is my second best film of the year, and it is my favorite international film. It's better than Parasite. It's better than Les Mis. It's better than everything. It's the second best movie of the entire year. 1760, so it's a period film. Got your costumes going on. Female painter hired to paint a wedding portrait. Twist, she can't tell the subject that she's painting a portrait of her, so she kind of has to stare at her a bunch, and then at nighttime go and see if she can remember her face. That's just the one line plot. I really don't want to give too much away. The two French women playing Marianne and Eloise are hypnotic. I could not tear myself away from this film. It was so good.
I don't think you're giving anything away by saying that it's a love story.
It is.
These two women.
But I don't want to go too far.
No, but it's still important that is, you know, that's the central theme of this entire film, is that it's this mismatched love affair. The forbidden love, and the twist being a 1700s film.
Well, yes, forbidden, but no one's like breathing down their necks looking for them to slip up.
No. But it's like where you're used to seeing these forbidden love, you know, scenarios between a man and a woman. The twist in this film is that you've got this painter who is painting this portrait of a very reluctant bride-to-be, and there is a attraction that is palpable between them, and you know, so sparks fly with Portrait of a Lady on Fire, and so it's an art house film for sure. Yes, I do think that it probably should have been nominated above Les Misérables. It is a beautiful film, but it's still very much an art house film, and it still would have lost to Parasite. So it's one of those ones that. You know, you kind of go, well, whichever film they decided to throw into the mix, it doesn't really matter because it was a foregone conclusion.
There was nothing they could have done with the Parasite gauntlet. 1917 couldn't beat Parasite, so Portrait probably wouldn't either. It's directed by a woman, Céline Sciamma. So, you know, why couldn't she have been nominated for Best Director? You know, they're saying, why, you know, they were all men this year as they were last year. She crafted just the most beautiful, amazing, hypnotic. I can't get this film out of my mind.
It is a very beautiful film, very beautifully shot. It's on this remote island off the coast of France, and so it was interesting. I kind of compared it. It's interesting. I saw it way before I saw Little Women, so I saw it months and months ago. But like Little Women, it really has, it's these contemporary themes that you can latch onto, but in period dress. And so, you know, women being confined by societal expectations and why this woman is, you know, supposed to marry this particular guy. And so it kind of had a little bit of the same messaging and that same interesting twist on viewing this, you know, the past through a current lens.
It reminded me of Amy's speech about
right.
Women have to take into the calculus, not love, but economics.
Right. And so that's what sort of thinking back, reflecting back on Portrait of a Lady on Fire, having seen Little Women much more recently, I sort of, Little Women was kind of that mainstream version of story, whereas Portrait of a Lady on Fire is definitely the art house version.
All right, you saw what actually is the Valentine's Day film this year. It's called The Photograph. It's actually going to make a lot more money than Downhill. And we've seen the director's work before. Another woman director this week, that makes two, which is usually two more than we get. Stella McGee adapted in 2017 Everything, the young adult novel that we particularly tore apart. We tore the tendons and sinew out of that film.
It took a twist that was not good.
So does she redeem herself in The Photograph with Lakeith Stanfield?
Well, apparently she had a much better outing last year with, I think it was called The Weeknd, perhaps.
I did not see that.
And I didn't either, but that one actually had a fresh tomato and was supposed to be quite good. And so I would say that this one probably falls somewhere between her best and her worst efforts. The crowd certainly seemed to like it. It's interesting. I mean, it's a modern day romance, and it has been marketed really primarily to the Black audiences, but it has broader appeal. But so certainly at the screening that I was at, You know, it was a pretty, it was not the most integrated crowd that you could get.
Reminds me of when I went to see Girls Trip.
Yes, exactly. And it really was a Girls Trip kind of crowd that was there. And so, but it stars these two very beautiful people, Issa Rae, who people might know from HBO's Insecure, and Lakeith Stanfield, who is in FX's Atlanta.
He's so good in that.
He's so good. And he was also very good in Sorry to Bother You. I know you really love that
movie. He was great. He was
like
the best actor of the year in that.
Yeah. So it's a modern day romance with these two. They're very watchable. They're very likable. But it's built to some sort of mystery relating to a photograph that is what brings these two together, and then it intertwines their current romance along with there's my phone.
Oh, I was like, that, there's no way that was me.
along with the romance that that Issa Rae's character's mother had had years before, and so that's kind of intercut. And so it's the thing is you figure it all out so quickly, and there's no drama. And so whereas some people are appreciating this film for the fact that it just is what it is, and it doesn't take some crazy everything kind of turn. Oof. Or icky twist, it also just doesn't have any real surprises. I mean, it went exactly where I expected it to go, and it was very slow to unfold, and I just was missing the drama. I'm more of a Nicholas Sparks kind of romantic drama person.
People on Valentine's Day a lot of times want to go to the movies and or maybe stay in and rent a movie. So this year, they can either choose, and help them choose, Hannah. They can go out and they can see The Photograph, or they can stay home and rent one that is out this week, Last Christmas. Which one is the better choice?
I think the better choice, which I am going to watch this week, may actually be on Netflix, the follow-up to All the Boys I Loved.
That's a cheating answer. You can't.
P.S. Yeah. I Still Love You. It's the follow-up sequel, yeah. And I'm actually looking forward to that one. And so I would say, you know, if none of these other films really float your boat, watch, you know, check out on Netflix if you haven't already seen
Portrait of a Lady on Fire.
No, but yeah. So if the it's a tough one. There are so many romantic dramas and romantic comedies that are classics that I would rather go back and rewatch an old one versus any that's out right now. None of them are, to me, your must-see films.
If you are a regular listener of the Cinema Clash, you know I frequently send Hannah a link. One that she probably won't like. It's outside of her comfort zone. She's like, why are you making me watch this? Of course I didn't like it, Charlie. Guess who did what to me this week? I get this, hey, I'm going to watch Incitement. Here's the link on a silver platter. So I was, all right, I'll sit down. You know, we've watched similar, it's from Israel. We've watched plenty of films in Hebrew. Well, because of you, we watched plenty of films in Hebrew, and I've learned a lot.
It was Israel's hopeful for the Oscar.
It swept the Israeli Film Academy Awards, and I've learned a lot about Israel and certain things. I already know a lot about it because of my job. But this takes place in a particular time and place. We're talking 1995 Oslo Accords. Yitzhak Rabin, Yasser Arafat, there's Bill Clinton between the two. And it's actually, I did not hate it at all. I actually quite like this film. It's so absorbing, and it exposed me, this Gentile, to a country I am really geographically, culturally unfamiliar with. They do a lot of things that I have no idea what they're doing. Why, you know, getting married seems very easy over there, by the way. They just meet a girl and they're just married. I'm actually very interested to know what your father would think about this film, because he would have an informed opinion.
He saw it. So I did ask my parents last night before I finished watching this film what they thought of it. And it's very interesting. It really starts, it starts in 1993 with the Oslo Peace Accords being signed. And I remember that time and how there was just this expectation, it was just, you know, people were hopeful for the first time in a long time about even the potential for peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians after just decades and decades and decades of a cycle of violence. And so what incitement is really about is it's all about the impact that the Oslo Peace Accords had on this one guy who became radicalized, a radicalized Jew, who ends up killing Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. And so Rabin was assassinated in, I think, 95. And so it was like, what could possibly have led this Israel-loving, observant, you know, law student Jew to assassinate the Prime Minister of Israel? And so that's what this film is sort of taking you through, what this guy is using as his justification for sort of saying that Rabin was being a traitor to the Jewish people by essentially, you know, having these Palestinians, having the prisoner releases and allowing them to get some territory back. And so it's a very interesting perspective on what happened back then. And my parents, you know, they found it very interesting. You know, I didn't get the sense that they loved this film, but I think they appreciated the just the perspective that it was taking to kind of help inform why this guy did what he did. But it definitely is going to rub some people the wrong way, too, because you just feel... You still don't feel this guy has no remorse to this day for what he did, and that's a problem. And you just see too how it just makes you feel like there's just no hope for peace in these kinds of situations, because every time somebody steps forward and is willing to take that risk towards peace, there's just always going to be some radical out there who might kill you.
Well, you mentioned. You mentioned everyone was hopeful, you know, they're finally going to sign a peace treaty and maybe both sides can move on. However, most of the people we see in this film, especially in Yigal's circle, the main character Yigal, nope, they don't want peace. Peace actually means wiping the Palestinians off the map. They're very anti-Rabin. There's footage of Benjamin Netanyahu, and his crowds remind me of Trump crowds, and they have these slogans they're yelling about Rabin and what they want to do to him actually echo to this day. But were everybody that hopeful? Because it looks like tens of thousands of people were hopeful in the other direction.
No, I think from a global perspective, people were a little more hopeful. So like in the U.S., we felt that there was a little more hope for finally making some headway in an Israeli-Palestinian peace. I mean, I'm sure it's the same, you know, it really was that next step from the Camp David Accords. It was like, all right, here you fast forward a couple of decades and let's take this next step towards trying to find a peace. And it just reminds you how hard it is and how frustrating it can be, because no matter what, and it's a worldwide issue where you just have extremists on every side of every issue that are always going to be working against, that are going to feel so passionate about their position that they are just never going to that they're never going to yield, and the consequences can be deadly, and then you end up starting all over again, and it's a very frustrating cycle.
Well, he's a law student, and looks like he's through the law, through Jewish law, he's trying to justify what he is planning to do, and that's where I learned a lot about what the law of the informer, the law of the pursuer, and these metaphors and stories from the Torah that I had never heard of. Good Lord, this is some inside baseball.
Yes, but you're also twisting, just as with anything else, you're twisting words to fit your own agenda. And I think that's where people are going to disagree with the interpretation. And so he's interpreting some of these words one way and finding people that are going to validate his position. And then you're going to have, hopefully, a lot more people who go, that's not what this is saying. That's not what this means. And for every line you point out that you view as a justification, I can give you a line that's going to show why what you're about to do or what you're thinking about doing is by law and just morally, ethically, and legally wrong.
Yeah, I could see his modern day version, the modern day of Yigal, was in Charlottesville carrying a tiki torch.
Yeah. And I mean, it's like modern day. You know, we're talking the 90s. It's not that far in the past. And so it just makes you wonder what the next steps could be and how in the world they're ever going to accomplish peace.
All right, our final film is a documentary, What She Said, : The Art of Pauline Kael. If you don't know who Pauline Kael is, she is still considered to this day one of the top two film critics of all time. She was a longtime writer for The New Yorker, and this girl could spin a yarn. I went back and read some of her work after this film, and gosh, can she write. This is her documentary. Where did she come from? Why is she still considered so controversial? Who was she? Written and directed by Rob Garver, a guy you have something in common with.
What's that?
You went to Northwestern, so
did he go to Northwestern?
He is a Northwestern
alum. Then I'm kind of
alum.
I'm kind of sad then that a Northwestern alum didn't actually put together a better documentary.
Well, there's your standard talking. There's Alec Baldwin, and there's a whole bunch of directors. There's Ridley Scott, Paul Schrader, Quentin Tarantino, Francis Ford Coppola, saying, look what she did to my movie Apocalypse
amazing
Now.
Amazing talking heads and amazing insight, but the construction of it and the use of video clips and things, I just didn't feel that it tracked all that well. I just think that for somebody who was constantly analyzing film, she would not have been all that thrilled with the construct of this documentary on her.
Probably not. She apparently also had this orbit, this circle. She was the prophet, and she had disciples. What were they? They weren't Paulettes, but they were something like Paulinistas. And she helped people get jobs. She championed them, but she also expected something in return. If she took a particular, unpopular opinion or championed a particular film, she expected a certain amount of loyalty that you would champion that film as well. I also learned that she would wait. She would wait for everybody else to publish, and then she would dive in a particular angle on what they're talking about in the zeitgeist and attack the film from that way. And I almost considered that cheating. If I see a film, I want to write about it immediately, publish along with everybody else, and we will see where the cards lie. Who lines up over here? Who lines up over here? She would wait for everybody to get on the mat and then jump on them from the top rope, as she is the final arbiter. She has the final say on film, which I can also see would have back then, maybe still today, have rubbed people the wrong way.
I just love, though, that she would not have been a participant in any of those Netflix junkets that there was so much brouhaha
about
over.
About a million years.
I love that she declined invitations to go to screenings because she wanted to see these films with regular people. And I could totally embrace that. I love that about her. I would have disagreed with her on a lot of movies. I could tell that. But I think I would have loved debating certain things. And I think she managed to really carve out a very legendary niche for herself in a man's world of film criticism when she did. So she sort of really paved the way for a lot of other women critics. And so I appreciate learning more about her background and what made her so influential and that she stuck to her guns on so many things. And we've done it before where there are movies that we just champion and we all talk about it. Portrait of a Lady on Fire, we had people in WAFCA who championed that movie. They said, here's one that you guys really need to watch. And it made an impression,
but nobody
and a lot
expects
more of us watched.
Loyalty. No one expects come out and say you liked it.
No, and that's where there's a divide because, everybody's entitled to their opinion. And so if you don't like something, you don't like it. And you can't force somebody to like it or make these quid pro quo deals that I liked it and you now need to like it. Otherwise, I'm going to do something with one of the next films that you really like and I'm going to pan it. And then it's going to just absolutely suffer greatly because my influence is stronger than your influence. I mean, there was some of that and I would have had a major issue with that. But she stuck to her gun. She was true to her own principles about what she liked, what she didn't like, what she expected other people to like. And it would have made for some fine debates. She would have made a great, great guest on the Cinema Clash.
Well, she was before my time. She had quit writing by the time I really got into, I was in high school, or not even that by the time she stopped writing. But I put her to the test this week. I turned on Turner Classic Movies, and I watched a Woody Allen film, Interiors, the film right after he did Annie Hall. So 1978 is his first drama, knocked everybody out of the water. There you have Diane Keaton not happy, not laughing. She's actually quite sad in this film. So I watched it. I had my opinion about it. That was all right, but, you know, a little overdone. But so what did Pauline have to say? And I called up her New Yorker review, and man, she took a tangent on this film. You could tell she published last on this, and she went after the mothers, Geraldine Page and Maureen Stapleton, both Oscar-nominated for this film, by the way, and got into this whole tangent about the Jewish mother. And like, if this is a standard Pauline review, which is fun to read, she's such a good writer, I would read what she has to say about anything, but it wasn't actually all about the film. It was about what she wanted to write about, which right. happens to me every now and then. I just want to write what I want to write about.
Yeah, and I have that inclination as well. I never read her. I mean, she was before my time for when I was really into reading a New Yorker article and before I was into reviewing films at all. But it was one of the first things that when I started reviewing movies, it was one of the first things that somebody gave me was the biography of Pauline Kael, which is still sitting on my shelf. So now I really feel like I need to read it. I think the most important lesson that you get out of watching this documentary, even understanding Pauline Kael, even if I didn't think that the film itself was all that great, that films are subjective. And she is basically acknowledging that it's her opinion, like it or not. You should like it, but if you don't, that's okay too. And that's why we all do what we do. I really wonder how she would take to the new wave of things like Rotten Tomatoes and aggregated consensus kind of reviewing out there now that did not exist in her time. And a debate, a Martin Scorsese debate about cinema versus Marvel movies.
I have no idea if she would have liked them or not.
I don't either. But I think
she has no problem with a blockbuster.
Right. So I think that's the kind of debate that her voice is missing, that it would have been great to hear what she had to say there. But I don't think she would have survived in a Rotten Tomatoes world.
Yeah, I don't know. Spielberg says she's the only one who got Jaws. No one else got it but her. All right, quick recap. We split on the Oscars. Good Lord, we split on the Oscars. Everything I liked, Hannah hated, and everything Hannah liked, I hated.
Yeah, pretty much.
That's awesome.
So we'll see next year
happens. It's good when that happens. I'll let you know next week what I think of Sonic. I'm going in with a good feeling. Downhill.
Downhill, you can wait for the rental. And if you've seen Force Majeure, let us know how they compare, since Charlie, you refuse to see this remake.
I'm not going to see this remake. I'm not going to do it. Portrait of a Lady on Fire. Good grief. If you haven't seen this film, what is wrong with you? Get out to your local art house theater right now and see this movie.
It is your art house pick. If you're not an art house film buff, then you're not necessarily going to love that movie.
Yeah, I don't know about it. The Photograph.
The Photograph, I personally think it's another one that can wait for a rental, but it's an easy watch. So if you're just looking for just a modern day romantic drama that has some funny, cute moments with two very pretty leads, then yeah, go for it.
Incitement from Israel. You need to go in with a certain baseline of knowledge. You have to know who Yitzhak Rabin was, what he stood for, what was going on in the mid-90s. If you do know that, I think you'll enjoy it a lot.
Yeah, this is one that I see doing really well, like on the Jewish film festival circuits, but it would be very hard to find an audience outside of that.
What She Said, : The Art of Pauline Kael. I think this was our actually longest review of the episode. We really got into it, but no, it's not the greatest documentary out there.
No, it really is only if you are familiar with Pauline Kael and always wondered more about her backstory. This will give you that, but I think you'd probably be better off just reading some of her past reviews as you did.
Life Itself about Roger Ebert is actually a much better documentary.
Yes, it is.
All right, well, thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.